I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett is calling it appalling. A videotape released today showing one of 15 captured British sailors apologizing for entering Iranian waters last Friday. Beckett is also rejecting a letter from Iran, insisting that Britain admit its fault. Meanwhile, the Iranian government also released a third letter it says was written by the only woman in the group. In it, she claims to have been, quote, sacrificed to the policies of the British and U.S. governments. Joining us on the line is Iran specialist Chris Rundle, formerly with the British Foreign Office in Tehran in the 1980s. Mr. Rundle, showing the sailors on camera, releasing these letters, which sound stilted, there's even talk of putting the sailors on trial in Iran. How is this affecting diplomacy?
In one way, it makes the people here absolutely think that Iran is outside the bounds of normal behavior. In other words, it's unacceptable. But any sort of impartial observer must realize that these so-called confessions are being made under duress. And to some extent, I think the Iranians are, so to speak, shooting themselves in the foot, because I take this incident really to be part of the general confrontation between Iran on the one hand and the UK and the US in the other.
Well,
Iran's image will not be helped by their behavior at the moment.
I want to talk to you about the parallels, if there are any. Do you see any parallels between this situation and back in 1979 when the American embassy workers were held hostage in Iran? That was a much longer situation. This one doesn't look like it might end quickly.
Yes, I mean, I can't help thinking that they are almost reverting under President Ahmadinejad to the behavior of the, shall we say, immediately after the revolution and the taking of the hostages. But another slight parallel is between this incident and a British businessman, Roger Cooper, in the 1980s, who was eventually released after several years. And he was held incommunicado for a long time and then appeared on television confessing. So this is a part of a pattern of behavior.
There are more U.S. warships in the region, but the United States statements have been muted so far. I'm looking at the newspapers in Britain this morning. They have that British woman, sailor, one of them showing her with her baby, another one in captivity with the veil, wearing the Islamic veil. Are the statements by the United States, the muted statements, somewhat surprising, considering Britain is one of the United States' strongest allies there?
No, I think it's the best kind of support that the United States can give us, because thinking of Iran's behavior, and some people sometimes say I'm an apologist for them, but I try to get behind their heads, so to speak, and I think that they really will want to look for a way out, and if you put too much overt pressure on them, it's that much more difficult for them to climb down.
Mr. Rundle, do you think this has anything to do with the capture of Iranians in Erbil and northern Iraq in January by United States forces? Is there a deal in the making in their minds, in the Iranians' minds?
Well, that would be the worst thing, but so far I gather that there has not been any mention of such a thing. In fact, the Iranian deputy foreign minister said that there was no question of asking for such a deal. My fear is perhaps that if this whole thing drags on, the Iranians will start not necessarily asking for a straight swap, but saying, you know, that we want something in return. So, I mean, I think the short answer is there's no direct link, but it could become an issue.
If there is the danger of a protracted struggle here, then, of course, the emphasis needs to be on somehow solving it soon. But do you see any room for face-saving here?
Well, I do, in that Iran can say that right is on its side because it's got these confessions out of the detainees. So they could say to their public, Britain was in the wrong, and so on. So, you know, it's not impossible at the moment.
Chris Rundle, president of the Center for Iranian Studies at Durham University in Britain. He formerly worked with the British Foreign Office in Tehran in the 1980s. Mr. Rundle, thanks for your time on Here and Now.
You're welcome.
And now, home to the U.S., where the sound of gunfire is being heard more and more on the streets of many cities. New statistics note a sharp rise in homicides since 2005 in cities like Boston, Memphis, Philadelphia, and Orlando, to name a few. As a television reporter in Boston, I parachuted into hundreds of shooting scenes. Get the video, a photo of the victim, interview an eyewitness, a relative, mix it up with some cop talk, and I was gone. A couple of weeks ago, I decided to stay and take a closer look at living with urban violence. I moved into an apartment in one of the worst areas of the Boston neighborhood of Dorchester. The week after I move in, 18-year-old Quintessa Blackwell is shot dead within sight of her house on a wooded side street next to an elementary school with a spacious playground that lets you imagine you might be in the suburbs. She had gone to the store for a snack and was talking to a young man who was apparently the target of the bullet, says her father, Segre Blackwell.
She, like, talked to everyone. Maybe that was her trouble. She was too friendly.
The photographs on the shrine near her home show a friendly face, a winning smile, and a taste for ties and pinstripe suits. While others she knew hustled marijuana, Quintessa sold cable TV packages door-to-door. In a diary of her goals, she noted, "Without my dreams, I'm going nowhere."
It seems like a quiet street. Did you feel safe here?
About as safe as anywhere else. It could happen anywhere. It's just something that happens. It's going to happen no matter where you're at.
One of Quintessa Blackwell's friends is Kyle Johnson, a fellow 18-year-old who's seeking redemption after a career in gang crime that started at 11, when he got shot in the back and it didn't hurt as much as he now wishes it had.
I thought, like, okay, movies lie. That put the wrong impression in my head because I started feeling like, okay, I could eat any bullet you send at me.
Go down to the lights and take the left, actually.
Okay. One night, Kyle and I drive through neighborhood streets where gangs rule with violence and fear.
What's here to fight about?
It's territory, like. Against us, they must be protecting their territory. They don't want us to take over here, start making all the money over here, start getting all of the girls over here. This is, I guess, what a lot of them consider home, or just an escape from home.
When you say money, what's the money to be had?
What's the money to be had? It's crack money, it's drug money. Everything's drug money or some type of hustle, like, I mean, it's just money.
The struggle for turf and drugs inevitably leads to shootings. On the first warm night of the month, with the hunch good weather would bring bad news, I joined the medics of the Boston EMS on the night shift. In a two-hour burst of violence, we rushed to a teenager shot in the chest, then a man stabbed in the back in an alley, and a young man shot between the eyes. I climb into the back of the ambulance as paramedics cut off his clothes.
You got a headache?
Yeah.
All right.
So, guess what? We don't know where the bullet went, but you're still awake and talking to us, so that's good, all right? When we get to the hospital, there's going to be $50 million poking and prodding. All right? Come on. Sleep.
You don't know. Whatever you do, do not fall asleep.
Don't blow your nose, all right?
The medics do extraordinary work in extreme circumstances. And EMTs, like shift commander Joe O'Hare, have actually kept many shootings from becoming homicides.
I think our technology and our knowledge and our abilities to care for patients before they get to the hospital has improved to the point where I think there are a fair amount of people who 10 years ago may not have survived the ambulance ride to the hospital because of the nature of their injuries. Those people survive now.
He doesn't know it yet, but tonight the 19-year-old is probably the luckiest man on the face of the earth. X-rays will show that the small caliber bullet has fragmented on impact, and instead of traveling to his brain, the fragments have lodged against his spine without breaking it. What seems to be keeping the homicide rate lower than it might be is improving skills in medicine and declining skills at shooting. Gang members are shooting more often, less accurately, and from farther away, too often hitting unintended victims who happen to be in the wrong place, close to the wrong people. Circumstances suggest the 18-year-old shot in the chest tonight was the intended. He's a thin, handsome kid, and he's unconscious. I watch medics pump his chest. I look into eyes wide open. Medic Joe O'Hare stands beside me.
He's not breathing on his own, obviously. He has no pulse. He has a breathing tube in. He has IV started. He's getting oxygen directly into his lungs, and that's something that needs to be done if there's any chance, you know, to save him.
Right there, I'm hollering. I'm just the boy that shot him right there, taking his drug.
Outside the hospital, friends and relatives of the victim gather in grief and anger. Soon, he becomes a case for the homicide squad.
Wouldn't even let me get my nephew's chain or nothing. Y'all stay at home. Don't y'all come down here. Y'all stay at home.
A week after Cedric Steele was shot and killed on the street, his funeral has drawn over 1,000 people. As his mother, his aunts, and grandmothers wail, men and teenage boys cry, and speakers struggle.
Why? What do we do? That's all that keeps running through my mind. What was it, jealousy? Envy? This is crazy, man. Why? I don't understand.
I think of a line in a hip-hop song. Every day there's a funeral. They just remix the eulogy. Reverend William Dickerson's sermon repeats familiar themes.
We're being held captive in our own communities because we're afraid of the young boys with the pants half down their behinds and hoodies on their heads. I'm fed up with our young black boys killing each other. I'm going to the street and I'm going to love them to life and let them know it's more to life than shooting. It's more to life than trying to be a baller. It's more to life than all of this foolishness.
There have been no arrests yet in the murder of Cedric Steele, or in the killing of Quintessa Blackwell steps from her house, or in the case of that 19-year-old shot between the eyes. Last weekend, a young woman from out of town took a bullet to the head thought to be meant for someone else. No arrest in her death either. And 2 nights ago, just down the street from my apartment, a young man was shot twice, point blank, in the head. EMTs say they can expect extra shifts this summer.
Why should I feel?
Just ahead, another city's turmoil. We go to Philadelphia. Back after the break, you're listening to Here and Now.
Must the shadows come? Why?
I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. At the end of last year, 406 people had been murdered in the city of Philadelphia. That number will be 488 at the end of this year, if it keeps up to the current pace, which has led some people to dub the city of brotherly love Killadelphia. Michael Matza of the Philadelphia Inquirer joins us. Hi, Michael.
Hey, David. How are you?
Good. Michael, I know that before coming to Philadelphia last year, you were covering the Middle East. Tell me what it's been like for you coming to an American city to cover violence here.
Well, that's a really good question. A lot of my colleagues sort of look at me like, you know, is this familiar? I did a story this week about a woman who was killed in crossfire gun violence in southwest Philadelphia, and one of my editors sent me a nice note, and he said, you know, when you stop and think about it, it's not really very different than the way you would write when you were covering a day of violence on the West Bank. The weapons are not as visible here the way they are in the Middle East, because everybody in the Middle East is carrying, carrying AK-47s and M-16s, but there are plenty of guns in Philadelphia, and when they come out, they kill people.
tell us more about that woman who I understand was shot to death while rushing into the street to get her children out of harm's way. And I think someone in that piece referred to it as the gunfight at the OK Corral. The difference being was that there were some good guys at the gunfight at the OK Corral.
This is one of these really murky, murky situations in which neighbors living in row houses on two blocks that are separated by a 35-foot city street ended up coming out of houses with weapons and shooting up the street. The police found 40 pieces of ballistic evidence, shell casings, fragments of bullets, cars were shot up. And this wasn't one of these things in which you hear that a white van pulled up and in some drive-by. This was a neighborhood incident in which people spilled onto the street from houses and started shooting at each other. And, it's very hard. The code of the street is, don't snitch, and it's very hard for the police to find out what's really happening. But they believe that this thing was sort of triggered by a drug robbery that resulted in some bad blood between two factions. And this woman, who by most accounts didn't have anything to do with any of this, I mean, she was related to a common law husband and a brother who had some involvement, but she had four children, and they're out on the street, and she hears the shooting, and she goes out, and she gets killed. She gets shot with one bullet in the head.
After these latest shootings, your police commissioner called on every superior officer, that's from captain on up in rank, to perform four-hour tours in uniform to bolster police presence. Has that made anyone feel safer?
No, and in fact, it's being looked at as largely symbolic, but it is an attempt to sort of make the police presence more visible on the street. I think it's an example of sort of desperately reaching for straws, frankly. We don't quite know how to get a handle on this situation, and we're trying several different things, one of which is this captain level and higher assignment to the street in uniform. We've got special tactical units that are trying to hit the streets looking for specifically for guns. There's a movement to try and see if they can change Pennsylvania state law so that a city like Philadelphia, which is having a much bigger problem than central Pennsylvania, can enact stricter gun laws. I mean, the National Rifle Association is very powerful in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is where they film the Deer Hunter. It's a state that for which having weapons is a pretty commonplace thing. But in the urban areas, particularly Philadelphia, they want to be able to sort of opt out of the general way the laws are applied in the state. And they've made efforts to pass laws that would restrict purchases to one a month, and they haven't been able to get that through the legislature.
Michael, in one of your stories, you quote a black man speaking approvingly of the notorious hardline former police commissioner and mayor Frank Rizzo. That person says, "We need help. When Rizzo was in, there was fear that kept us straight. That's the help we need." So did that statement surprise you?
It did surprise me. Coming from a 46-year-old black man who would have remembered a time in Philadelphia when African-Americans felt that the police force wasn't always their friend. But this same man was talking about a sense of exasperation that a neighborhood that once seemed to have some kind of values had just sort of frayed so badly that he was ready for harder line solutions. I mean, there is a black mayoral candidate in Philadelphia. We have a mayoral primary coming up in the middle of May, and one of the African-American candidates is a firm supporter of what they call stop, question, and frisk as a way of finding some probable cause to approach kids hanging on corners and see if they got guns and take them away.
Your murder rate's now ahead of New York City's. How big is that murder rate an issue in this campaign?
It's a huge issue. Most of the candidates will say that public safety is the number one priority, because if you can't feel safe, you can't do anything. At the same time, it's complex. There's a recognition that police can't simply arrest their way out of this problem, that it's a complicated thing that involves employment, it involves trying to create some opportunities for youth so that they're not idle, because their idleness just leads to trouble. Without getting sort of bleeding heart or too sociological about the underpinnings, there is a recognition that it's not just you know, a law enforcement problem, and that just being tougher in and of itself is going to do anything.
Well, it's pretty clear that the federal money has dropped out. Here in Boston, a sharp decline in the murder rate during the 1990s has been attributed to that federal money that came in to make better policing. Are people in Philadelphia blaming that lack of federal funds as well?
Yeah. The police commissioner, Sylvester Johnson, often says, you know, we have money applied to homeland security. What about hometown security, you know? And some of the solutions that these mayoral candidates, for example, are trying to propose is finding ways to tap into that homeland security money in urban areas. In Philadelphia, we're talking about trying to install gunshot detection equipment, audio gunshot detection equipment, and video cameras. They currently have some, but we're talking, one of the candidates wants 1,000 video cameras. He wants, you know, high-tech audio gunshot detection equipment so that the police can react more quickly.
High-tech equipment on the one hand. On the other hand, we're talking about just basic old-fashioned community policing. As you said, Michael, very complicated issue. Michael Matza of the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure, David.
You're listening to Here and Now. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. They live on in their letters and their instant messages, in their emails and in recordings made for their kids. They are soldiers who were killed in Iraq. And their words fill a special issue of Newsweek magazine called Voices of the Fallen. The correspondence includes so-called last letters soldiers write in advance, to be sent home only in the case of their deaths. Like this one, written by a Marine Lance Corporal killed in Anbar Province.
Hi, Mom, Dad, Brittany, Jeremy, and Bailey. If you're getting this letter, then I'm sure you've already heard. I'm so sorry. But know that I'm safe now. I'm with God watching over you. You all mean the world to me. I hope I've made you all proud, and please don't be sad. I made it to heaven before you, and we'll see you all again. Your loving son and brother, Anthony Edward Butterfield.
Dan Efferon is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek, and he joins us with more on Voices of the Fallen. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, David.
By the way, you can see and hear from these soldiers on our website, here-now.org. And Dan, I have to say, this stuff makes the burden of sacrifice of our soldiers very, very real and gut-wrenching.
One of the things I think we internalized reporting on this is the big gulf that exists between military families across the country and the rest of us in the way the Iraq war is experienced. These families turn to the pages of their newspapers every day, not just to see what's going on in Iraq, but to see if their loved ones are being wounded or killed.
Dan, it strikes me, I think in World War II, something like 12% of Americans were involved in the fighting. In Korea, I think it was 4%. In Vietnam, less. Here, you have less than 1% of Americans involved, and yet those 1% are making themselves known back home almost instantly with their messages.
Some of the letters that we gathered were from service members who were killed just a few weeks ago. We had reached out to nearly 1,000 families. And I think the first thing that the families wanted to know was, is this thing going to be political? Are you guys going to use these letters of our loved ones to make a statement for or against the war? Once they were reassured, there was a real outpouring to our reporters with these things. And we received emails from the families. We got faxes with handwritten letters from service members. We received tapes that had the voices of their loved ones. Some of them talk about politics. Some of them question what they're doing there or talk about their sense of mission. But for the most part, what you get in these words is just the day-to-day experience of being over there, the worries, the patrols, the longing for loved ones back home.
I'm looking at a statement by Terry Clifton, whose son, Marine Lance Corporal Chad Clifton, was killed by a mortar in Anbar Province. She says, "It's become very important to me that these soldiers and Marines are viewed as individuals with lives, dreams, experiences, and families. They aren't cardboard cutouts in shades of red, white, and blue." Was that a common sentiment you heard?
Yes, it was. And I think it was one of the things that was very important to parents or to wives and husbands. One of the things that characterizes this war is that we're not just sending 19, 20-year-olds, but a lot of reservists, a lot of guardsmen. And the letters we got are from a real varied bunch, including these young men and women, but also Major Mundell, who's 47 years old, who left behind four children, all 18 and under. And I think the letters bring out about not just the individual voices, but the fact that people over there who are serving in Iraq are a large cross-section of the American public.
This story about Major Michael Mundell particularly struck us. Tell us more about him.
Major Mundell was in the military for 11 years, and he left the military. And then in the run-up to the Iraq War, he rejoined, really knowing that he was going to go over there. And he wrote nearly 200 letters home in the months that he was in Iraq before he was killed. Very eloquent letters, very descriptive. And you get a real sense for what goes on in Iraq. I think he had a deep sense of mission. But some of the letters, he talks about not knowing who is on what side of this conflict and how you get in between these factions and try to restore some peace.
Dan, let's read some of those letters here. This war is not like the big war. There are no sweeping maneuvers with hundreds of tanks pouring over the border and so forth, Mundell tells his 17-year-old daughter. And that's on October 27th, 2006. It's a fight of 10-man squads in the dark, of ambushes and snipers and IEDs. When I go out to fight, it's usually with less than 20 men, and I go out to fight almost every day.
My dearest Eddie, thank you for the letters. You know that I always want to hear from you whenever you can spare the time to drop your daddy a note. Now, daddy is wearing all his combat junk. I look like a stormtrooper from Star Wars. Pretty scary. But this little boy walked up to me and held out his arms for a hug. So I squatted down and gave him a hug. It was the coolest thing. The kids seem to like us. Some of their parents do as well. They smile and wave and so on. Some don't like us. They give us nasty looks and don't speak at all. Those are the ones we worry about.
And then his wife Audrey is talking about a letter that Michael sent to his son Dale that apparently she didn't know about.
My youngest Dale got a letter from him. He was killed on Friday, January 5th. He got a letter on January 8th, the following Monday. He had written him a letter from school that I didn't know he had written. And so apparently Mike had answered him back. It was bittersweet, I guess, because he had wanted some last words from his dad, and he had prayed for that. And I think that was the answer to his prayer, even though it was very difficult. But I think in years to come, that'll be something he'll cherish forever. He'll always, always keep that.
So letters are the best way I can hear from you and your brothers and sister. It is always so nice to get one. When I got it, I took off my helmet and sat on the hood of my Humvee and read it. I also shared it with my guys. Getting a letter from home was always special. I miss you very much and can't wait to see you when I come home, Dad.
Then there's the story of Marine Captain Alan Rowe, 35 years old when he died. This recording, I guess, was made in the summer of 2003 when he was in Najaf, and here he's singing to his children, Blake and Caitlin.
Baby, all I've got is this beat-up leather bag. And everything I own won't fill up half. Don't you worry about the way I pack. All I care about is getting back real soon.
Finally, Dan Efron, what are we left with here? What's the message? What do you want people to take away from seeing and hearing what's in this issue of Newsweek?
I think if people read this and get a sense for who is over there doing the fighting and what kind of sacrifices the families are making, how the families experience this war differently from the rest of us, and really a sense for the war itself, what the arc of this four-year war was in the words of these people who fought there and died there. If readers get a sense for that, we will have done our job successfully.
Dan Efron is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine, which is out with a special issue called Voices of the Fallen. It features the letters, journals, emails, and audio recordings of soldiers killed in Iraq. And there's a link to the magazine on our website, here-now.org. Dan, thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, on a happier note, it's down to the last few couples on the dance floor in the men's and women's Final Four in college basketball this weekend. And if you're tired of the dance and you don't think this is real madness, it's also time to play ball. Time for Hope Springs Eternal. And for our favorite guy on the dance floor and field, ice and pool, it's only a game host, Bill Littlefield. And talk about pools, Bill. How did you do on your brackets?
Well, to quote the immortal George Carter, oh, geez, don't even talk to me.
In the men's Final Four, which is being played this Saturday, Georgetown takes on Ohio State. And Ohio State has the almost anointed number one draft pick in this year's NBA lottery, 7-foot center Greg Oden. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the Norse god of war?
He may
hunt?
Easily be mistaken for same, yes.
And in the late game, last year's champions, the Florida Gators, take on the UCLA Bruins. Which game do you think is going to provide the most excitement, Bill?
Well, I think the fun thing about this Final Four is there are no pretenders. There are only teams that really deserve to be there. And each of these four teams could end up being a champion, and it wouldn't really surprise anybody too much. In the first game, you have Oden against Roy Hibbard, the Georgetown 7-2 center, so that'll be a good matchup. And in the second game, you have people wondering whether Joakim Noah can in fact do what he did last year and lead Florida to a championship.
So no clear favorite in this all?
No, I don't think so. I think that's the fun of it. It should be two good games and then a good championship game, which obviously means there will be a 30-point blowout in there somewhere.
Then in Cleveland on April Fool's Day, the women's Final Four is being played. North Carolina takes on Tennessee, and it's, I think, more mellow head coach Pat Summitt. That's an interesting story this
more
year.
More mellow than what, a volcano?
She was doing cheerleading stunts.
Yes,
she was at the top of the pyramid
this
year.
Safe to say she was doing cheerleading stunts on the night that the men were playing, not on a night when her team was playing. So don't be fooled.
Okay, and no fooling. Rutgers, perhaps the most surprising team of the tournament, meets Louisiana State University.
Yeah, LSU, of course, lost their coach just before the tournament began. Pokey Chapman was pretty much quit just before she could be fired because of allegations she'd had a relationship with a former player. They're being coached by a guy named Bob Starkey. He's never been a head coach before, and he really is quiet. I mean, he sits during games. He talks quietly during timeouts. The veins in his neck don't throb at all. It'd be fun to watch him. And they have Sylvia Fowles, who may be the most dominant player left in the tournament, great big center for LSU, terrific player. Rutgers, really one of my favorite stories, not only because they have Matee Avajon, who's a wonderful player, but they also have two players named Essence Carson and Epiphany Prince. And how you root against teams with players named Essence and Epiphany, I do not know.
And you have a strong educational program, too, which causes a lot of people to root for
Rutgers.
Well,
and plus you have a head coach who's taken three teams, including a previous Rutgers team, to the Final Four. C. Vivian Stringer, the only coach who's managed that, but she's never won a championship, so it's a bit hard to root against her.
Okay, enough hoop talk. Take me out to the ball game. Seems like the world's going to be watching the biggest K since Special K, Dice K. And having watched The Natural again last night, no kidding, I'm reminded that I'm not reminded of Barry Bonds, whose quest to break Hank Aaron's home run record is going to succeed in all likelihood if he stays healthy, and we're told he's healthy.
Right. If he doesn't fall on his face, he should break that record, which some people consider to be the most hallowed and important record in baseball. Put me down for Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, by the way. But anyway, it will be interesting to see how Bonds is received. We know that he's loved in San Francisco. Apparently can't do anything to change that. But around the rest of the league, it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
You're also talking about a great story for me, that barrier breaker on Only a Game this week, and that's the late, great Buck O'Neill, the Major League's first black coach. Tell us about that.
Well, Buck was the Major League's first black coach. Of course, he's best known as the star of the Ken Burns baseball documentary. That introduced him to the world. He's the greatest ambassador that baseball ever had. And, of course, people expected Buck, when they first heard from him, to talk about what an injustice it was that he couldn't play in the Major Leagues. He came along too early. And Buck's constant refrain has been, I came along at just the right time. I had a wonderful life. Don't tell me things were bad. I rubbed shoulders with Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, no problem. And the book is terrific. It's about Buck's last few journeys talking to the world about baseball.
A man of great dignity. Bill, we're going to be looking forward to that in the rest of your show. Only a Game. It airs this weekend on NPR stations around the country. Don't miss it. Bill Littlefield, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And stay with us. We're only in the seventh inning. There's more. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Remember those gangling years of adolescence when your parents were an embarrassment, your friends' opinions meant everything, and one look from a would-be admirer sent your hormones raging? For most of us, and count me in, those are moments best left forgotten. But a group of performers is drudging up those moments and putting them on stage by sharing their own high school journals, love letters, even poems.
The poem is entitled Un Amor de No Correspondida. You wait for the skater outside the classroom, our classroom. One look and I'm not there anymore. You make me disappear. Don't touch her by your locker. I don't want to disintegrate. I'm about to disintegrate.
My words flow like an Elizabethan sonnet, and all that money, my name is on it. 6 foot high, I'm so alive, I'll make you cry from the rhymes I derive. Stepping to me is like stepping to Bruce Lee. I'm a master at rap like he was at karate.
You were the bomb, girl! And even though that sounds cheesy and homeboy, it's the utter truth. You are the bomb. The bomb that makes my heart explode.
Are you cringing yet? It gets worse. The show is called Mortified. The cast, aspiring actors and ordinary people with a morbid desire to share their own adolescent insights. Here and Now's Kevin Sullivan caught the show here in Boston.
I guess I was writing this to Pierre Cardin, just to show my age. Dear Pierre, your new collection is divine. I love what you're doing and wish you all the best. It's been 2 years now, and I think we should merge. Why not?
Cheryl Caligari is channeling her tween alter ego, Natasha, a pint-sized power broker modeled after Dynasty diva Alexis Carrington. As a kid, Cheryl played out her boardroom fantasies by typing letters to imaginary clients. Now she's sharing those memories with about 200 strangers at the Paradise Lounge in Boston.
Last year, you know, my Chanel No. 5 was an estimated $25,000 success. Aim high. Pierre Cardin is a smash, and so is my new cosmetics collection. Everyone is talking about it. Let's have dinner at the Chateau, and we can discuss the details. Let me know, and I'll have the lawyers draw up the contracts immediately. Yours truly, Natasha.
We're devoted to one very unique thing, which is creating sort of a comic excavation of teen angst artifacts. That's letters, lyrics, journals, home movies, and more, and letting their original authors share them with total strangers. And somehow they agree to do it.
That's Mortified creator Dave Nadelberg, a 30-something hipster from Los Angeles who came up with Mortified after finding some old high school love poems that failed to impress. Now, he's helping others exploit their adolescent angst on stage with Mortified shows in 10 cities.
One of the fun things is getting to take ordinary people, whether it's architects or advertising execs, soccer moms, and kind of letting them get their rock star kicks on stage for a night.
Ordinary people like Sharon Jeldon. According to the Mortified program, she dreamed of becoming a writer and ended up, quote, pregnant again. That kind of self-deprecating humor is a Mortified must. Here's Sharon.
Cheap Jew is about the worst thing to be called in the entire world. The other worst thing in the entire world to be called is rich Jew. I'm walking a very fine line here. Bye, Sharon. Dear Diary, I made a big, giant mistake. I drove Dad's car to school today. In social studies, in front of the whole class, Mr. Johann goes, Miss Katz, I saw your car. Very nice. I wish I could have a Volvo someday, too. Oh, my God. I'm, like, totally freaking out. Now I'm a rich Jew.
Mortified is like stumbling through a soundtrack for the 1980s and 90s and then admitting you actually like the songs. Tunes like this Peter Gabriel favorite, Come Talk to Me, bookend each performance. It's easy to relate to the performers because, unfortunately, we've all been there.
These are all my friends from around Boston.
Rebecca Tuck is a 35-year-old mother of three from Natick, Massachusetts. This will be her first time on stage.
Where's the husband? Uh-oh. Now, did you guys know each other in high school?
No,
Oh, boy. Okay, husband. Excuse me. She just described to me some of these diary entries, and she said she was kind of boy crazy.
You don't have to say kind of. She was all over the boys in seventh grade. She wouldn't have liked me in seventh grade.
Why is that?
I think I had one girl date me for maybe 5 minutes in seventh grade. She had about 50 boyfriends in seventh grade.
So what do you think of her coming out here on stage and sort of bearing her seventh grade soul?
I'm glad we're doing her seventh grade diary. I've heard some of the later entries in her diary. I would be mortified.
Dear diary, Cindy likes Ben. I just like him as a friend. I found out that loving is not just good looks, but friendship.
On stage, Rebecca reads from a weathered, palm-sized diary. It looks like it spent years abandoned at the bottom of a box in an attic somewhere. Her husband, Ben, probably wishes it had stayed there.
Dear diary, I'm confused. I think I'm really in love with Billy, but today I was talking to Mark and he said John wants to go out with me. Then we started laughing and he asked me if I'd go out with him. Then he said, you'd never go out with me, even if you weren't going out with Billy. And I said, who said? Then he asked me, well, would you? And I thought a minute, then I answered yes. After that, he told me, don't be surprised if Billy suddenly gets murdered. And this is the last journal entry. It's June 27th, 1985. Dear diary, help. My mom read my diary.
That music intros 25-year-old Chuck Young. At 16, he wooed his first girlfriend with notes that were part Dr. Dre, part Celine Dion.
When I saw you, I was all, damn. And you were all, right? And I was all, right on, sweetie. And so on and so forth. I'm glad you liked the kiss. I liked it too. If I kissed you all of the times I wanted to, all hell would break loose. Stay true, sweetheart, and keep it real. Love, gangster.
I guess that's a mortified generation for you. But will it last? After all, who writes notes in class anymore when there's email, text messaging, and online journals on websites like MySpace? Here's Chuck.
I can go and look at someone I don't even know and look at their journal and see how kind of pathetic their life has become. So yeah, I think we probably are, you know. We're almost the last generation that can kind of get away with this, I'd say, you know?
And based on this last entry, maybe that's for the best.
I'm in love with you. So in love. You are my rose. Rose as in a beautiful flower, and rose as in Rose from Titanic. And hopefully someday I can be good enough to be your Jack. And she responds, you are my Jack. You already did save me. Aww. Oh, yeah, I had her.
Here and now is Kevin Sullivan getting mortified at the Paradise Lounge in Boston. To see if the show's in your area, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again, Here and Now. And now we leave you with more mortifying moments from the Alexis Carrington wannabe, Natasha.
I want you to know that my new cosmetics collection is a hit. My Chanel number 5 and Chanel number 19 is taking the world by storm. I also have great models that you should use for your new commercial. Television is the future. And I think we can do this. Yours truly, Natasha.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.